Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 58, Krishna Marries Five Princesses. We are reading text 23 through 29. We're doing text 23 together. Pitavadad Gudakesho Vasudevaya Sopitam Vratam Aropya Tadvidvan Dharma Rajamupagamat Pitavadad Gudakesho Vasudevaya Sopitam Ratam Aropya Tadvidvan Dharma Rajamupagamat Tathavatad Gudakesho Vasudevaya Sopitam Ratam Aropya Tadvidvan Dharma Rajamupagamat. Thus, Avadat said, Gudakesha Arjuna Vasudevaya to Lord Krishna, Sa, He, Api, and Tam, Her, Ratam, on his chariot, Aropya, taking up, cut of all this, Vidvan, already aware, Dharma Rajam, Kipim Yudhisthir, Rupa Gamat, he went. Translation and purports by the disciples of Vidvan Dreshya Bhopad. I'll just read through the next text. Shukadeva Goswami continued, Arjuna repeated all this to Lord Vasudeva, who was already aware of it. The Lord then took Kalindi onto his chariot and went back to see King Yudhisthira. 24. Describing a previous incident, Shukadeva Goswami said, upon the request of the Pandavas, Lord Krishna had Vishvakarma build them a most wonderful and amazing city. Report. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti mentions that this city was constructed before the burning of the Pandava forest and hence before the Lord found his bride Kalindi. 25. The Supreme Lord stayed in that city for some time to please his devotees. On one occasion, Sri Krishna wanted to give the Pandava forest as a gift to Agni. And so the Lord became Arjuna's charioteer.
Good boy.
Srila Jiva Goswami explains the sequence of events that occurred during Lord Krishna's stay with the Pandavas. He states that first the Pandava forest was burned, then Kalindi was found, then the city was constructed, and then the assembly hall was presented to the Pandavas. 26. Being pleased, O King, Lord Agni presented Arjuna with a bow, a set of white horses, a chariot, a pair of inexhaustible quivers, an armor that no fighter could pierce with weapons. When the demon Maya was saved from the fire by his friend Arjuna, Maya presented him with an assembly hall in which Duryodhana would later mistake water for a solid floor. Then Lord Krishna, given leave by Arjuna and other well-wishing relatives and friends, returned to Dwarka with Satyaki and the rest of his entourage. 29. The supremely auspicious Lord then married Kalindi on a day when the season, the lunar asterism, and the configurations of the sun and other heavenly bodies were all propitious. In this way, he brought the greatest pleasure to his devotees. Om Janapanam Vishadhananjana Sahara Tatsavim Tanam Tasma Shudhananjana Panchakakati Vishadhi 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 Vishadhi. It's good to be back in Alachua. I've been gone for a little while. I also feel somewhat humbled giving class here in the esteemed presence of my Sannyasi Dad brothers. So I beg their forgiveness and my impudence in speaking today. And I'll do my best as following the schedule here, returning to Bhagavatam class. It's a very more interesting stories that we're hearing from Srimad Bhagavatam. This is a real recap or summary of some of the different events that are happening. Some of these are explained further in other parts of the Bhagavatam, and of course Mahabharata and other scriptures, but this is a little bit of glimpse of some of the wonderful pastimes of the Lord during this time period. I just thought so, it's very similar, but just, you know, so we get a little bit of the flavor of Srila Prabhupada, just a couple paragraphs that he writes in Krishna book on the same topic that we're just reading, the same verses that we've covered. Srila Prabhupada says, after this, Krishna was asked by King Yudhisthira to help in constructing a suitable house to be planned by the great architect Vishvakarma, the celestial engineer in the heavenly kingdom. Krishna immediately called for Vishvakarma, and he made him construct a wonderful city according to the desire of King Yudhisthira. When the city was constructed, Maharaj Yudhisthira requested Krishna to live with them for a few days more in order to give them the pleasure of his association. Lord Krishna accepted the request of Maharaj Yudhisthira and remained there for many days more. In the meantime, Krishna engaged in the pastime of offering Kandava forest, which belonged to King Indra. Krishna wanted to give it to Agni, the fire god. Kandava forest contained many varieties of drugs, and Agni required to eat them for rejuvenation. Agni, however, did not touch Kandava forest directly, but requested Krishna to help him. Agni knew that Krishna was very much pleased with him because he had formerly given him the Sudarshan disc. So in order to satisfy Agni, Krishna became the chariot driver of Arjuna, and both went to the Kandava forest. After Agni had eaten up the Kandava forest, he was very much pleased. This time, he offered a specific bow known as Gandiva, four white horses, one chariot, an invincible quiver with two specific arrows considered to be talismans, which had so much power that no warrior could counteract them. When the Kandava forest was being devoured by the fire god Agni, there was a demon of the name Maya who was saved by Arjuna from a devastating fire. For this reason, that former demon became a great friend of Arjuna, and in order to please Arjuna, he constructed a nice assembly house within the city constructed by Vishvakarma. This assembly house had some corners so puzzling that when Duryodhana came to visit this house, he was misdirected, accepting water as land and land as water. Duryodhana thus became insulted by the opulence of Pandavas, and he became the determined enemy. So that's actually described in chapter 75 of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Duryodhana is insulted. And, of course, at that time, he became a very determined enemy. That was kind of like the final straw for Duryodhana when he really decided that, you know, he was the mortal enemy, the eternal enemy of the Pandavas, and thus the first war became more and more inevitable. So interesting pastimes here, and there's a sequence of events which isn't completely clear, but Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur and Jiva Goswami have clarified, because what is happening here is one incident is being told, the marriage of Kalindi, but then the story of the Pandava forest, and that actually happened beforehand. So according to our acharyas, the sequence of events here is, first of all, the Pandava forest was burned, then Agni presents the bow, the quiver, the arrows, etc. to Arjuna. And in that forest fire, the demon Mayadhanava was saved. Then later, Kalindi was married. The one reason that we know that is was mentioned when before he meets Kalindi, he's going out hunting. And it's mentioned in that verse that he's hunting with his Gandiva bow and his arrows. So in other words, that had already happened previously. Then Vishwakarma builds the city of Indraprastha, and Mayadhanava builds this wonderful assembly hall, which I guess is full of all sorts of like trick mirrors and ways that you can't tell whether you're walking on the land or on the water. And of course, they all knew all the tricks, but Duryodhana did not when he came to visit. So he became a little bit insulted at that time. Text 29 is an interesting verse. The last, we didn't read it actually, the last verse of the Sanskrit is Vishvavan Paravanandam Svanam Paramamangalam. So this word Paravananda Svanam is mentioned here, which means that Krishna gives the supreme pleasure to the devotees. So this is sort of a theme. Of course, in many narratives, we don't have a lot of purports, so as speakers, we're always trying to find some theme to speak on. But this seems to be the consistent theme throughout the last few different incidents and pastimes that are mentioned, that Krishna is giving pleasure to his devotees. He's obviously giving pleasure to Yudhishthira because he spends extra time and stays with him simply to give him the satisfaction of that relationship. He's involved in so many relationships with Arjuna, giving him pleasure, driving his chariot. Even way before the battle of Kurukshetra, he's driving the chariot of Arjuna. And giving pleasure to Agni, his great demigod devotee, he's the fire god, by offering the forest to him. Obviously giving great pleasure to Kalindi. Kalindi had wanted and had vowed to only marry Vishnu. And was performing austerities in the Yamuna River, and of course was so greatly pleased that Krishna came specifically to marry her and fulfill her greatest desire. And he's even giving pleasure to Mayadhanava, who is considered a demon, but yet he's doing devotional service for Krishna and Arjuna and the Pandavas. So we see this theme throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam, throughout Krishna's relationships with his devotees, in his pastimes, in Vrindavan, in Mathura, etc. That he is interacting with his great devotees in such a way that there's this mutual exchange of happiness and pleasure. It's described in Nectar Devotion that a spiritual pleasure is one of the six results or characteristics of devotional service in one of the beginning chapters. So one of the attributes of bhakti is that it gives happiness or pleasure to the living entity that engages in it. Prabhupada explains, I just read this one, explains that Prabhupada elaborates quite a bit in the Nectar Devotion that there are three sources of happiness. There's the happiness that comes from material enjoyment, the happiness that comes from the non-realization and personal realization, understanding that one is spirit. And then there is the happiness that comes from bhakti, the devotional service. And obviously, bhakti is considered to be the supreme. And it's explained that these other types of happiness have so many shortcomings, and they do not give that same happiness that comes through the performance of bhakti yoga. There's a very well-known verse in the Bhagavatam 2:17. It says, both by the rising and setting of the sun, It decreases the duration of life of everyone, except for one who utilizes his time by discussing the topics of the all-good personality of Godhead. In Srila Prabhupada's purport, he says, even a fraction of the duration of life wasted cannot be compensated by any amount of gold. Human life is simply awarded to a living entity, the jiva, so that he can realize his spiritual identity and his permanent source of happiness. A living being, especially the human being, is seeking happiness, because happiness is the natural situation of a living entity. But he is vainly seeking happiness in this material atmosphere. So all of us are pleasure-seeking. It is part of our nature. We have Sachit Ananda, eternal constitutional sarup of the living entity, is that we seek pleasure, that we seek happiness. Happiness is in pleasure part of who we are as spirit souls. So when we come into this material atmosphere, Sri Prabhupada says, we are vainly seeking it, the happiness, because it is natural. The real happiness is there in the spiritual world, but yet we try to find that in this material world. Why? Because this material world is a reflection of the spiritual world. This is described through many, many places. Of course, the example of Banyan Tree is given in the Bhagavad Gita, how it is a reflection where the roots are upward and the branches are downward. And in other words, it's explained that everything is there in the spiritual world, a reflection of it is here in the material world. So we see things in this material world that have a source in reality, in that spiritual world. Prabhupada explains this in the introduction to the Bhagavad Gita. Very nicely, Prabhupada says, the material world is but a shadow of reality. In the shadow, there is no reality or substantiality. But from the shadow, we can understand that there is a substance and a reality. In the desert, there is no water, but the mirage suggests that there is such a thing as water. In the material world, there is no water, there is no happiness, but the real water of actual happiness is there in the spiritual world. So sometimes we might think, well, why is the material world this way? Why are we seeking happiness here, but yet we are not finding it? There is no happiness, because it is this reflection. So what we're seeing is the mirage. Just as in the desert, there is a mirage. And we've all experienced this. Sometimes you even see them on the highway, right? Kind of when the sun, maybe But somehow or another, when the material conditions are right, we see these mirages, and it really looks like water, you know. And you would, if you did not know, and it's the first time you saw one, you would swear this mirage is water. And apparently, if you're out on the desert and you see these mirages, you know, you could be so thirsty and looking for water, and you think, finally I found it. And so you run to that mirage, and what do you get? More sand. Or if you're in the highway, what do you get? More asphalt when you get up to that place where you thought there was water. So this is the way the material world is. It is the reflection. It gives us the promise. It gives us the promise that there will be happiness. I will enjoy my senses if I just do it right. If I do it in a different way, if I try one more time, perhaps I need to have a different body or a different lifetime, or perhaps I need to be on a different planet. All these things, the living entity is thinking, different ways that maybe I can achieve happiness. But yet every time that happiness is frustrated, every time we are simply doomed to more sand and more asphalt. So it's not there. But the fact that we are seeking it, the fact that we see these things, these mirage-like substances, which seem so much like real happiness, suggests that real happiness does exist. And that happiness does exist in the spiritual world. And that is what we're looking for. That is what every living being is looking for. So we can experience that real happiness, that real love, everything, relationship, those things that we are seeking in the spiritual world, but only in relationship to Krishna. You take Krishna out of the picture, out of the equation, it doesn't exist. Even those who try to find some happiness in impersonal understanding, taking Krishna out, but still trying to have some spiritual experience. There is some experience. There's a tiny amount of happiness compared to the amount of happiness in the water in a pastoral tank compared to the ocean of water that is there in bhakti. The ocean of happiness that is there in bhakti. So these are the descriptions that we have. And so we know that in this material world, we won't experience that, and there's a very simple reason why. Because we are trying to experience this apart from Krishna, apart from God. Therefore, we want to experience pleasure individually only for the self. This is the nature of the material world. Even in our closest relationships, where we think that there's some reciprocation, there may be some love, there may be some exchange, there is a little bit there, but primarily all relationships are defined by pleasure to the self. And the proof of that is that when that relationship no longer pleases me, it ends. Right? I've said this before, but you know, does anybody go into a relationship, does anyone get married thinking, well, I'll probably get divorced. This probably won't last. No. Everybody thinks the relationship will endure. Everyone thinks this is really love. Even though we know 50% of marriages end in divorce, we don't expect that will happen to us. You know, everyone thinks that relationship is going to go on eternally, or at least for this lifetime. So why is it that so many that start so promising and with so much strength and conviction in that relationship end? Because at some point, it becomes not satisfying to the person. In the beginning of relationships, there's often a sense of sacrifice, right? Oh, I'll do anything for the person, whatever you want, you know. So in other words, much more sense of giving, less sense, and more sense of sacrifice, less sense of the self. As that relationship goes on, that sacrifice and selflessness doesn't give a lot of satisfaction, and one falls more into sort of our default nature in this material world of being selfish, of looking for material pleasure. And if that material pleasure is not there, then one looks for that pleasure somewhere else, in a new partner, in a new person, and thus we have this huge divorce rate. People go from one partner to another thinking maybe this one will bring me happiness. And of course, it's not just in romantic relationships, but all relationships can be characterized as, even relationships between parents and children, which tend to be a little bit less selfish. Prabhupada said that the closest relationship to a spiritual relationship is between a mother and a child. But even still, we see that there's no guarantee in these relationships. When I became a devotee, when I joined the Hare Krishna movement, my parents didn't speak to me for several years, because I was no longer doing things that were pleasing to them. This wasn't their idea, dropping out of college and going off and joining the stream of religion. So therefore they did not want to have a relationship. And that ended over time. I finally went back to college, and then I was okay again. When I became more material successful, then they thought, then they were pleased. You know, they should have been pleased that I was becoming spiritually successful by finding my spiritual master and finding my relationship with God. That's what parents should be pleased by. You know, if their children are able to take up Krishna consciousness. Because our duty is to liberate our dependence from the cycle of birth and death. Anything short of that, we should not be so happy about. But at any rate, we see that this tends to be the rule in the material world. If there isn't enjoyment or happiness, pleasure in that relationship, it tends to be given up. And we find that even in religious relationships, that holds. How many people give up faith in God when they find there's something that's not pleasing about that? Sometimes people, I've even known devotees, but because things, there were reverses in their life, or they were experiencing some unhappiness, they were experiencing some difficulty, they tend to say, you know, give up their relationship in Krishna, or give up, if they're in another religion, they give up their faith in Him. Because there was something that was materially not satisfying to them. So this is not true spirituality. This is not bhakti. This is not devotion. Bhakti is actual love. And actual love is reciprocal. It's a shared relationship between the lover and the beloved. And it's also steadfast. It also doesn't change. It's not something that one gives up easily when one is not pleased or one is not satisfied. So in a devotional relationship, in bhakti, both Krishna and the living entity wish to please one another. So the devotee's desire is to please Krishna, and as one becomes more and more pure in one's devotional service, that becomes more and more steady. One reaches the stage of nishtha, of steadiness, then that doesn't waver so much. No matter what happens in one's life, whatever the material circumstances are, that faith remains strong and remains dedicated to one's loving relationship of service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And that service becomes the life and the soul of the devotee. Krishna also has a same, but because, of course, we cannot compare ourselves as tiny, infinitesimal living entities to Krishna, but Krishna also has the desire to please his devotee. He's called Bhaktivatsala. And that's one of his characteristics, one of his names, one of his attributes, that he gives pleasure to his devotees. And you know, he has so many names like Govinda, he gives pleasure to the cows, to the Brahmins, to the senses. So this is one of the things that Krishna does. Krishna gives pleasure to his devotees. And his devotees try to give pleasure to Krishna. So this is this reciprocation of love. This reciprocation of devotional service is characteristic of bhakti. And this distinguishes very much from other religions, other spiritual paths, other philosophies. This is fairly rare. In fact, when we talk about the six characteristics of devotional service, it is rarely achieved. Isn't that one of them? It's rarely achieved. That's one of the characteristics. It's not so common. You don't see this very often. This idea of a reciprocal, loving relationship between God and the living entity. So we're very fortunate that we have this opportunity by the mercy of Srila Prabhupada, to have the Srimad Bhagavatam, and particularly to have the Srimad Bhagavatam translated into the English language so that we can experience and enjoy and learn from these most elevated relationships between Krishna and his devotees. And now that we're in this 10th canto, we are hearing about these most wonderful pastimes in Dwarka and Pura and Vrindavan between Krishna and his devotees. And we can see just how much loving relationship and reciprocation is. So this is something that we can learn from. That we can understand the nature of bhakti and become happy. And understand that this is the real happiness of the living entity. And it cannot really be found anywhere else. There's nothing that is going to give us the same happiness or the same satisfaction as we find in Krishna consciousness. I read and this is a lecture that Srila Prabhupada talks about the process of bhakti. He says, this process of devotional service is a very happy one. Why? Devotional service consists of simply hearing the chanting of the glories of the Lord, or one can attend philosophical lectures on transcendental knowledge. Simply by sitting, one can learn. Then one can eat the remnants of the food offered to God, nice palatable dishes. In every state, devotional service is joyful. One can execute devotional service even in the most poverty-stricken condition. The Lord says, patram pushpam phalam, even a leaf, a flower, a bit of fruit, or a little water, which are all available in every part of the world. These can be offered to God by any person, regardless of social position, and will be accepted if offered with love. So, of course, the key is that we are making our offerings with love. And even if we don't feel so much love, if we continue to make those offerings, at least with a little faith, that love will develop. That love will come about. And this is why Srila Prabhupada so much encouraged us to somehow or another take up Krishna consciousness. It's interesting when you, especially some of the early, some of the early lectures of Srila Prabhupada in 66, 67, it sounds, many times for these new group of devotees who do very little, or these audiences of people that just, they never really heard of Krishna, heard of Krishna consciousness. Prabhupada is practically imploring and begging them, you hear it in his voice, please don't waste the human form of life. Please take up this Krishna consciousness. Because Srila Prabhupada knew, he had that faith. He had that knowledge given down by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to his spiritual master, the Guru's Acharyas, that if one did simply take up this process that he is mentioning here, this simple process of hearing and chanting and digging through jhana, then people would experience the spiritual happiness. And once that spiritual happiness is experienced, then one will continue. Then one's faith grows. I think all of us, every single person who became a devotee, experienced spiritual happiness at some point. And that happiness that was experienced gave us more impetus to continue devotional service, which of course it becomes a building, relationship of continuing to serve and experiencing the happiness that comes from devotional service, and thus it continues on. And when the faith becomes strong enough, then even if one is not experiencing so much happiness at one point, one doesn't become easily discouraged, one doesn't give up that relationship, one doesn't give up in relationship with Krishna. Knows it'll just take some time. Knows that if we're in this material world, we're in these material bodies, it will not come about immediately. It will take a little time for us to develop that Krishna consciousness, to develop more and more bhakti, to develop more and more spiritual knowledge, to become more and more purified. Most importantly, it's that process of anarthanavritti, of getting rid of all of those material attachments. And that takes a little bit of time. But in the meantime, while that process is happening, we're very fortunate. Krishna gives us a little bit of taste, a little pleasure, a little happiness along the way, so that we become encouraged in Krishna consciousness. And we begin to understand, or begin to experience what that means, to actually have a reciprocal, loving relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. To understand that God not only wants our love, wants our service, but he wants to give his love to us. And he wants us to experience his love for every living entity. So it's a very, very wonderful process, a very special process, and we're very much fortunate that Srila Prabhupada has come to witness this. So thank you very much. All the glory to Srila Prabhupada. Questions or comments? Let me first ask Maharajas if they'd like to comment.
Thank you very much for a very clear, lucid presentation. One very minor, tiny comment, and one potentially major question. The minor comment is, when you were reading, I remember you reading that in the case of Maya Dhanava, Prabhupada described him as a former demon.
So former demon.
I guess he started doing some constructive work in relations. The question comes up that Prabhupada said, Krishna says, the Supreme God, the Mahavira, and he assured us very thoroughly that looking for pleasure and happiness is natural as spiritual, we're supposed to be Satchit and Ananda, so it's a very natural thing. And that if we take the devotional service, then we'll be satisfied to experience that happiness and pleasure. In fact, that's been noted even by outsiders, not exactly outsiders, someone like Harvey Cox in the late 60s, early 70s. I remember reading an article in the New York Times magazine section where he was describing, it was about the Hare Krishnas, and he was describing the Hare Krishna devotees as the greatest hedonists. Now, usually hedonist seems as someone's performing sinful activities, but he said they get this bliss, they get this happiness that's like off the scale. I mean, it's just like better than anything that we've experienced in the material world, whatever. But then on the other hand, we have Bhaktivinoda Thakur. He's saying, Nija Sukha Bhuli Sudinaridaya. He's saying, let me forget about my own happiness. We have many indications that the whole idea of devotional service is not to be at all selfish, but not to be, it may be natural, but just to think of how I can make Krishna happy, how I can please the Lord, and not think about my own happiness. So it seems like a contradiction. Maybe it would help.
Wonderful point, Maharaj. I would say not a contradiction, but one of those spiritual paradoxes. You know, we have a lot of these paradoxes where this is true on one hand and also on another hand. I mean, our whole philosophy is based on this idea of a chintadeva-deva tattva, being conceivable simultaneous, one and different. So we have these paradoxes throughout our philosophy. Yes, the devotee is not concerned for his own happiness. The devotee is only concerned for Krishna's happiness. And whatever Krishna wants is what he wants, or she wants. But by doing so, by more or less abnegating one's own desire for happiness, one is simultaneously, inconceivably, given all happiness. In other words, Krishna gives that happiness or pleasure to the devotee who more or less is willing to give up their own pleasure. And I guess thinking about it, because I can barely understand these pastimes of the rasa dance and gopis, and I don't pretend to have any insight on them, but I was thinking that was one of the examples, wasn't it, when Krishna said to the gopis that they have to be satisfied just by their own devotion. What can I offer you? What can I give you? You've given up everything. So you'll have to be satisfied by your devotion. And we know that the gopis, in one sense, were feeling all this distress, all this separation, but yet they were feeling the greatest ecstasy in ways that are inconceivable to myself and to most of us. Yeah, so that's good. If you have any other ideas on it, or... Okay. Next class, you can expound on it. Yeah. Donovan, if you want to comment on anything, or... Hare for answer.
So in presenting this to in preaching, sometimes I forget that investment bankers, they work on Wall Street and they work 100 hours a week, 90 hours a week, they don't sleep, they don't eat. Why are they doing that in search of happiness? And they manage to do it all their lives in the search of happiness. Because there must be some taste there. There must be something that they're getting. Now, if somebody says, well, there is a parallel devotional service as well, you claim that there is happiness in devotional service. Well, how do you know that you're actually experiencing spiritual happiness as opposed to just happiness like the investment banker? So you're chanting every day, working so much to the bone, serving, and so on. So what is it possible?
Well, there's a qualitative difference between material happiness and spiritual happiness. And, we could pose so many different arguments or say how it is different, one is ultimately for oneself and how one is, and the other is, this selfless service. But, probably say the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And I think that ultimately we have experienced some degree of material happiness, also some degree of material suffering, and we've experienced some degree of spiritual happiness. And we feel that. We know that. We understand the qualitative difference between spiritual and material. That's why so often, sometimes when, you know, people, especially if they're very argumentative or they're sort of intellectually, mentally challenging like that, sometimes the best thing to do is just to try to somehow or another get them to do devotional service. But often we'll say, all right, just try it. You don't have to believe it. You may have all of your arguments, but just chant Hare Krishna and see for yourself. Because if they do, then they will actually experience the difference between the happiness of chanting Hare Krishna and the happiness of working 90 hours a week on Wall Street, which I can't imagine how that can be happiness. But, you know, there are different modes of nature, and obviously someone extremely in the mode of passion, I suppose, could find pleasure in that. You know, that extreme fruit of work and getting the results and, you know, the whole sort of thing. There must be something there. Probably funny for you.
Do you mind if I propose another response to that, Mike?
Mm-hmm.
A Wall Street financier is desperately trying to arrange circumstances because he believes that happiness is dependent on the circumstances. And he may get some pleasure out of that arranging, but deep within himself, he knows that ultimately circumstances will fail. Whereas a devotee begins to experience in all the time that it doesn't matter what circumstances there are. I'm getting a feeling of faith in reality and a satisfaction which is very deep and which transcends anything that will happen ever in this material world. So that's how he knows. That's how he's sure, because it's experienced by him directly.
Wonderful answer. Thank you very much. Yes, exactly. Spiritual life is not dependent upon the material circumstances. All material happiness is dependent upon the arrangement of those circumstances. Very good. And you know, I mean, I'm kind of similar to really the left side of the room.
I remember reading in the Bhagavatam when Swami Bhuvamanu gives his daughter to Kadamuni and he comes back and describes that how he enjoyed material happiness in the Krishna conscious atmosphere.
Oh, when they were enjoying for so many thousands of years.
It describes about Swami Bhuvamanu himself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, when he came back, maybe Keshav can look in the folio that
say it again.
As I said, I hope I'm quoting it, but described that he enjoyed material happiness in the Krishna conscious atmosphere.
Okay. I accept that, the words of the Bhagavatam. Enjoy, well... There is some enjoyment in the material world. There's a little bit. There's a little bit of suffering and quite a bit of suffering in the material world. Actually, and if one is in a Krishna conscious atmosphere, one would be situated more in the mode of goodness. And we know that the mode of goodness brings happiness. So I would assume that there, you know, in other words, a devotee is experiencing some mode of goodness happiness. How's that? Good shot at it? And if anyone has a better explanation or more insight into that, I'm happy to do it. I think that's part of it. I mean, obviously there's some happiness there, but yeah, as you said, one is not particularly attached. If one is spiritually situated, then, you know, one experiences happiness and distress, right? I mean, happiness comes, distress comes. It's not like we say there's no happiness, we never can experience any happiness when we're there, but we don't, as you said, we don't become attached to that. We don't you know, that's not what defines us, or that's not what drives us. I mean, the happiness may or may not be there, may come, and we're more situated in the mode of goodness, but it's not primary. Devotional service, the state of bhakti is primary for the devotee, and the other states of material happiness or distress are secondary. Well, before I get totally out of my depth, probably time for a final word from the Lord.
Just a suggestion that I always find it helpful to, whenever we talk about happiness, or verses in the 18th chapter about happiness in the different modes, and you mentioned that very tragic figure of the 50% divorce rate, so it may indicate, seems to fit the bill of happiness in the mode of happiness. It's at the beginning, it's a real place for honey, and then it deteriorates naturally. At the beginning and the end, it picks up. So we have to follow the process nicely, so we'll be on the way back to home, back to Godhead, we'll also be relieved of the basement, just to play the base mode of happiness will become much more durable.
Thank you. Okay, Madan Mahan, last question or comment.
Thank you. In response to Maharaj's statement, I was thinking also in 18.5 Bhagavad Gita, it mentions about acts of sacrifice are never to be given up. And it quotes in there the Vibha Jaga, the marriage ceremony. So in the marriage ceremony, they try to elevate the mode of passion to the mode of goodness by duty. And then if your happiness comes from the sense of duty in following out the religious performance of the sacrifice, then that happiness keeps the divorce rate from happening.
Yeah, that's a good point. I was thinking about that even when I was thinking about class today, that is one, it's sort of an exception to that everything based upon one's personal selfish pleasure. Some people, and you find it very rarely in the world, but still, it's there. Some once in a while, you have that sense of duty, a sense of duty, which certainly is a higher mode of nature, elevates one a little bit. Okay, all glorious to you, Bhagavad.